And it's truly a pleasure for me to introduce to you our first speaker, who is Marigold Melle. She's a Ross Baskin Professor Emerita at the law school here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's been a professor for over 30 years, and she was very instrumental in enhancing the law school's curriculum in the area of family policy. She's been involved in studies of child support and child support policy since the late 1970s. She's currently editing a book on child support. She's authored just numerous books and chapters and monographs throughout her distinguished career, which in the interest of time I won't enumerate. But I did want to highlight just a couple of the many honors and awards that she's received. She received from the Law Foundation of Wisconsin the Bell Case LaFollette Award for Outstanding Service to the Profession. She was also honored by the State Bar of Wisconsin Special Committee on the Participation of Women in the Bar for her lifelong contributions to the advancement of women in the legal profession. She also was honored by the UW System for outstanding contributions to the advancement of women in higher education. And all I can add to this is that, you know, I read through her resume very clearly, and one thing that's not readily apparent in the resume is the person behind the resume. And in my dealings with her, she has been a very kind, very considerate person, very generous in sharing her time and talent. She's been a tremendous supporter of the seminars, participating in two seminars as a speaker. She's written chapters in two of our reports, attended many, many planning meetings. So I wanted to thank her for that. And we're really pleased to have a scholar of her stature. And I think her really unmatched historical perspective of family law in Wisconsin. And her topic today is the current child support system, its background and rationale. And I, you know, this topic seems critical to me to the seminar. Who was it that said, it's difficult to know where you're going if you don't know from whence you have come? So without further ado, let me introduce Marigold Melle. Let's give her a hand as she comes up to the mic.
Maybe I should just sit down after an introduction like that, because it's going to be, I assure you, it'll all be downhill from here. My topic is to talk about, not so much about the current child support system, but its background and rationale of that system. And in doing that, I'm going to be reviewing a number of things, which as I look over this audience, I'll be refreshing the memories of many of you, and you'll probably remember more about it than I do and am able to tell you. But child support, that is the amount that a non-custodial parent is supposed to share with the child with whom that parent does not live, is not a new problem. But in the last decade or so, we have made drastic changes in the way in which the amount of that child support is set and in the manner in which it is collected. And I'd like to look first of all at how the amount is determined. Traditionally, child support was set on a case-by-case basis after both parents had the opportunity to present relevant evidence to a judge at a judicial hearing and to determine what and to tailor that child support order to the needs of that family. Or so we said that was what was happening. This was probably okay in the middle of the century perhaps, when there were a limited number of cases, communities were smaller, judges were able to spend the time to obtain sufficient evidence. But as our caseloads increased, we began to see more problems with it. Actually, there were a number of reasons why we came to the conclusion that this old case-by-case method had to be replaced. And I think that probably the most telling reason was that it was inconsistent and inequitable. There were study after study by scholars. It became sort of something that we scholars like to do, you know, go and look and see what was happening in this system. There were great variations from county to county, within a county, from court to court, And studies found that there were even variations before the same judge from case to case. Everyone knew someone who earned more and paid less in child support. So beginning in the 1980s, we made this dramatic shift in the way in which we determined the amount. We substituted a uniform standard for the case-by-case determination. Wisconsin was one of the early states to do this, to use a uniform standard. We, as I'm sure many of you know, call it the percentage standard. And the statute today provides that the court must use that percentage standard unless it finds, as I think by a preponderance, a greater preponderance of the evidence, that it's unfair not to use it. This, and what I'm going to be discussing now, is really how we came to develop that that standard, this percentage standard. We began looking at the approaches to setting child support. And there are two ways that you can look at this. One is cost sharing. So you come in and you look at how much, you come in with a budget for how much the child, it costs to raise the child, and the court determines how much the custodial parent is paying and then how much the non-custodial parent can pay. And that was the way in which it had been done in the case-by-case system. The other way of setting child support is the way which is in which it is done in almost all states today, and that is called income sharing. And this approach is based on the assumption that the parent should share a portion of income with the child with whom that parent does not live, based upon that parent's income. It is said to reflect, at least, more the way in which parents treat children in two-parent families. And as I say, this is the approach that almost all states use today. Well, having decided that, then you have to determine how much income should the parent share. And again, there are some alternatives. One approach that's been advocated quite a bit theoretically is that you should try to have to equalize the two households. That the children should have the same standard of living as their non-custodial parent. There are many arguments for this. One is that it's difficult for a child to live, to have two parents, one whose income is much higher than the other parent, and that therefore you should try to equalize the incomes. No state has adopted this. It's only been proposed theoretically. And it poses a good many problems in equity because if you, let's say you have a high income non-custodial parent whose income then is shared with the child but also with the parent with whom the child lives, this strikes people as being manifestly unfair. Conversely, if you're trying to equalize incomes, and I heard an argument before the Supreme Court just last week on this, if the non-custodial parent has a very high income, then what does that mean for the... I mean, if the custodial parent has a very high income, what does that mean for the non-custodial parent? Well, you know, theoretically, I suppose, you would perhaps have a transfer of income if you were trying to equalize these incomes. Well, as I say, no one has done that. We have done has been to look at the proportion that a parent would share with children if they were living together. This is a subject in which there has been a great deal of economic literature, but it unfortunately goes all over the place because it turns out that it's exceedingly difficult to estimate how much of your income goes to your children. One reason is because so many expenses, food, housing, and transportation are jointly consumed. Furthermore, the studies tend not to look at such things as the indirect costs in a two-parent family where one parent, usually the mother, may work less to provide custodial services in the to the family. So that we just don't have very good estimates on how much of their income parents do share with their children. Wisconsin based its percentage on studies done at the Institute for Research on Poverty, in which adjusting all sorts of economic matters, the conclusion was that it ranged from 16% to 50%. The economist's final suggestion or recommendation was that probably the best estimate was 20% for one child, and for the second and third child, about half of that amount. Well, if you look at something like this, you begin to realize that it becomes, first of all, a value judgment between 16 and 50%, and you also are trying to balance a number of interests. Obviously, you're interested in the child receiving enough income, or the custodial unit receiving enough additional income so that the child lives decently. You're also concerned about the non-custodial parent because the amount that you set for that parent to pay has to be something which that parent is willing to pay or is able to pay. And so balancing all these things, a political judgment, I guess you'd say, a value judgment was made. And Wisconsin, as I'm sure you all know, adopted 17% for one child, 25% for two, and on up to, I think, 35% for five or more. Now, the amount that Wisconsin, and this kind of incremental sharing of income has been criticized by a number of studies as not making an adequate transfer to the child. And I'm sure that if those of you who are legislators have heard criticisms on the other side of that percentage. And other states have come up with percentages, and they also range considerably, but generally within the 17 to some begin at 13 and go up as high as 45, I think, percent. But some of these other factors that I'd like to mention now very briefly enter into this. One of them is, what are you going to figure this percentage against? Wisconsin does it against gross income. Some states exclude varying various items. I had a judge call me up one day saying, "Professor Mellie, you people ought to look at such and such a state. They have a much higher percentage of income than we do, and you'd have much more adequate child support awards." Well, I went and looked at what that state statutes or rules provided. And I called them back and I said, well, the only problem with that is they may begin at 25%, but they exclude everything but the kitchen sink when you're setting it against it. So there have been studies, one commissioned by Congress, which showed that the states with their varying guidelines come out with about the same child support awards. A second issue that we looked at in setting this system that we have today was whether or not the percentage ought to decrease as parents' income increases. Wisconsin uses a flat percentage, and that was based on the research done at the Institute for Research on Poverty, which found that up to at least the very high levels, parents continue to spend about the same percentage of their income on their children. But many states provide that the percentage declines as income increases. Now, in both cases, we're all trying to reproduce the pattern of income sharing when a child lives with both parents. But actually, none of the studies that look at what parents share with their children have been concerned primarily with the issue of whether percentages decrease as income goes up, because they tend to take a certain income level and work with that. So we have no really good solid economic data on that. So one of the decisions that the Wisconsin policymakers made back in the 1980s was that absent that, it was really hard to justify a scheme that makes a working class parent contribute a larger proportion of that parent's income than a middle-class parent or an upper-income parent. Therefore, for one reason, for another reason, it's much easier to administer a system when you have the same percentage against all of the income ranges. And therefore, Wisconsin went with a flat percentage. Another issue that was considered and keeps coming up, again, if you're legislators, I'm sure you've heard of this, whether or not you should consider the income of the resident parent. Wisconsin figures child support only for the non-custodial parent, but many states consider the resident parent also. But they do it in an interesting way. They figure child support based on maybe on total income, and then they prorate it between the two parents, which of course comes out to being with the non-custodial parent paying the same as he or she would under the Wisconsin system. And the custodial parent doesn't pay child support. The assumption is that that parent will spend that amount on the child, which is, of course, the assumption that Wisconsin makes, that the resident parent probably is spending more, a higher percentage of his or her income on the child than the non-resident parent. It seems to me that there are a couple of places where considering the resident parent's income does make a difference. One of them is in the state. If the state lowers the percentage of income as income increases, then if you look at both parents' income and the resident parent's income goes up, that may kick you into a higher bracket where the percentage goes down, and therefore the resident parent will receive a lower child support payment. The second situation in which this may make a difference is in the shared time case. Wisconsin, up until about a year ago, I think, did not consider the income of the resident parent in the shared time cases. We now have changed our rule so that at least at a certain point we do consider that, but that certainly is one area where it does make a difference. It also, you may also, under the Wisconsin system, consider the income of the resident parent when you're looking at whether or not you ought to apply the guideline. Remember I said that the statute says you have to use, the court has to use the guideline unless it finds that it's unfair to the child or one of the parties to do so. This may be the basis for the court perhaps deviating from the guideline. I'd like, very quickly, to look at the second change in child support that we have made in the last 10 or 15 years, and that is in the manner in which the child support is collected. Traditionally, when the court entered that child support order, the parent was ordered to pay child support, and if that parent paid this under court order, but sort of voluntarily, after tax income and so on, and if that parent didn't pay, then the custodial parent had to go in to enforce a court order by contempt and so on, as we normally do. In the 1980s, we made again a drastic change, so that the child support order is now an order to the employer. It's an assignment of income to the employer to deduct child support from the income of the supporting parent. So the parent pays that income before he or she receives their salary or wage check, and it has improved collections. So just quickly to recap, in Wisconsin today, child support is based on a uniform standard based on income sharing, and it's collected with income withholding.
Do you have a couple questions, Sir Margo? The question is, now that this has been working for several years, under what situations do you see exceptions to and when the standards aren't used? Is that right, Karen?
Yes, we're beginning to see some patterns, and I mentioned As a matter of fact, there were two cases argued in the Wisconsin Supreme Court last week in which there was an argument, the argument was being made that you shouldn't use the guidelines. And I think these are ones that the legal profession sees as being possible reasons for deviating from the guideline. One was the case of a very high income non-custodial parent. Should you apply the percentage standard in that case, which, by the way, the trial court did? The other one was the case of the very high income resident parent. Should you apply the percentage guideline in that case, which, by the way, that particular trial court did? So it's interesting to see the trial court's not deviating in cases where I think maybe my profession might think, well, that's a good reason for doing it. Or at least my profession, when they're representing one of the parties, thinks that. One of the big areas where the courts don't apply the guideline is for low-income parents. And before the shared time guideline was changed, that was another area in which you found considerable deviation from non-use of the percentage standard.
Okay, let me see if I can restate that question. We're doing an audio tape for people who might be interested in ordering it, so I'm going to try to rephrase the question. So there was an exception set up in 1993, is that right, where there's an option where you can set aside money for people who don't have a regular wage stream coming in.
A trust fund.
And you're asking how often that is used.
I can't tell you that. I do know that in, again, one of the cases that was argued before the Supreme Court, the court had set up a trust fund so that the parent was one who had a very high income at the time that the child support order was set, but the court says specifically that he does not think that that high income will continue. The man was a football player. Kevin Van Kempen is here. He might be able to tell you how often this is used, but I haven't seen any statistics on it.
I don't believe it's used very much yet. It's used more for self-employed people where they have bank accounts, where you can draw against a bank account as an alternative to an income assignment, more than funding prepayment of child support. We've had two prepayment of child support cases where people have funded the child support entirely, or at least anticipated entirely in Racine, and that's working okay. You know what I mean?
Are family court judges and family practitioners even aware of this provision of the law?
The question is whether or not family court judges and family court practitioners are aware of the law. I believe that they are, because of the fact that the problem of the self-employed person has been a problem for quite a long time, and this is a good legislative remedy to deal with that. And so by now, forms have been drafted, banks have been notified, and what have you. So I think it's growing primarily because of the self-employed payer.
Okay.